Try Therapy Notes, the number one rated electronic health record system available today. With live telephone support 7 days a week, it's clear why Therapy Notes is rated 4.9 out of 5 stars on Trustpilot and has a 5-star rating on Google. Therapy Notes makes billing, scheduling, note-taking, and telehealth incredibly easy. And now, for all you prescribers out there, Therapy Notes is proudly introducing ePrescribe. Try it today with no strings attached and see why everyone is switching to Therapy Notes, now featuring ePrescribe. You can get 2 months free by using promo code CHAT at therapynotes.com. Trauma Therapist Network is a website to learn about trauma and how it shows up in our lives and to find a trauma therapist. Go to traumatherapistnetwork.com to find a trauma therapist near you today. If you're going through menopause, perimenopause, and you just can't seem to find comfort in your body anymore, or if you're done with menopause but you're still feeling like a wet sock on a busy highway, then you have to try Hormone Harmony. Hormone Harmony contains science-backed herbal extracts called adaptogens. Now, here's the beauty about adaptogens. They help the body adapt to any stressor. So Hormone Harmony isn't just for menopause. Any woman with symptoms of hormonal imbalances can take it, but it's perfect for those horrible menopause symptoms that put a woman's life on hold. Hot flashes and night sweats, racing thoughts and low moods, poor sleep and feeling tired all the time. Yeah, Hormone Harmony can help with all of these things. And the biggest benefit? Feeling like myself again. That's what women mention over and over in their reviews. For a limited time, you can get 15% off on your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code CHAT at checkout.
Therapy Chat Podcast, episode 407.
This is the Therapy Chat Podcast with Laura Reagan, LCSWC. The information shared in this podcast is not a substitute for seeking help from a licensed mental health professional. And now, here's your host, Laura Reagan, LCSWC.
Hi, welcome back to Therapy Chat. I'm your host, Laura Reagan, and I want to thank our newest sponsors. This show is able to go on because of sponsors. So thank you for supporting them. And I love to tell you about things that I love. And today I'm bringing you another conversation related to the topic of religious trauma. My guest today is Dr. Mark Karas. Dr. Mark Gregory Karas is a licensed marriage and family therapist with a full-time private practice in San Diego, California. He specializes in religious trauma and couples therapy and is a published author of the best-selling books Religious Refugees, Deconstructing Towards Spiritual and Emotional Healing, and the newly released The Diabolical Trinity, Healing Religious Trauma from a Wrathful God, Tormenting Hell, and a Sinful Self. And we were talking about that book today, his newest book. So I want to be clear for people who are listening that speaking of religious trauma is not bashing religion. It's talking about the traumatic aspects of some religious practices that can cause lifelong pain and trauma for people. And what Mark talks about in his book is the harm that can be caused by belief systems involving the idea that there's a wrathful God who punishes sinful people and they go to an everlasting hell. I mean, really, when you think about that, that's pretty obviously a harmful thing, especially to teach children before they have the critical thinking skills to decide what their personal beliefs are. And that's what we talked about. He talks about his experience of growing up in a family that had a lot of chaos and dysfunction, trauma and loss, and how that led him to turning toward Christianity. And then he had some experiences that were very transformative for him through that process and have led him to where he is now. So I hope you'll enjoy this conversation. Think about it. Think about how, if you're a therapist, how this might affect clients that you work with or people in your life, maybe yourself. As always, I appreciate you listening to Therapy Chat. Take care. Hi, welcome back to Therapy Chat. I'm your host, Laura Reagan, and today I'm very excited to be speaking with Dr. Mark Karas. Mark, thank you so much for being my guest on Therapy Chat today.
Laura, great to be here. Looking forward to the conversation.
Yeah, me too. I'm excited to talk to you about your work, your books, and the topic of religious trauma in general. But let's just start off by you telling our audience a little more about who you are and what you do before we dive in.
Sure. Well, who am I? Gosh, that's so existential. But I'll go to the more socially acceptable. I'm a therapist, private practice, San Diego, full-time practice. I was an adjunct at Point Loma Nazarene University for a little bit. And yeah, a dad, a husband, yeah, author, just came out with the fourth book, which we'll get in talk about today. And yeah, that's about it.
Congratulations. So why don't you tell us the title of your newest book?
Yeah, it's a big one. It's a big title. Healing the Diabolical Trinity, Healing Religious Trauma from a Wrathful God, a Tormenting Hell, and a Sinful Self. Yeah. So just to share with the audience, some people hear the Diabolical Trinity and think I'm being somehow pejorative to Christian understanding of the Trinity. So for some reason, I have to make that explicit. I'm not talking about the Trinity, but the interrelated understanding of, yeah, a wrathful God tormenting hell and a sinful self, otherwise known as hell indoctrination.
Well, yeah, I think that's great that you just explained that because it is a little bit of a provocative title, right? That
I would say, yes.
But the Trinity of a wrathful God tormenting hell and a sinful self are a pretty destructive group of three. So I think it fits.
Yeah, yeah. There's a reason that I sort of named it that way in the sense because I was just going to talk about the religious trauma of hell indoctrination. But then as I was wrestling through it and writing, I realized you cannot have a hell where there's eternal conscious torment without a wrathful God who created it. And you can't have that kind of hell without evil and sinful people to be put there for eternity. So there is this interrelated trifold nature of these of hell indoctrination that they can't be separated. And as you suggested, they have a lot of negative consequences. I will say not for everybody, which makes this an interesting conversation because another person's theological trash is another person's theological treasure. So there are people who come out unscathed with this kind of doctrine and praise God for being so just to have created a place like this because God is so holy. But I'm more focused on many people who have experienced it as traumatic. We'll talk about more about that in a minute, I bet.
Yeah, right. So if for those who this doesn't impact, we're not referring to them, but we're talking about people who have been traumatized by this and So let's start off with really, how did you get into working with and writing about hell indoctrination and religious trauma?
Sure. Well, I became a Christian. I'll give the shortened version here. I became a Christian at the age of 21. It was a very sort of powerful Damascus of the road experience. That's a, you know, allusion to the Apostle Paul and how Jesus, you know, knocked him off his horse. And he became a Christian after that. But I grew up in a very wildly dysfunctional family. Everyone has a dysfunctional family, I think, but mine was a little off the charts, sort of lifetime drama kind of experience. Mom addicted to drugs, died of a drug overdose, father mentally ill. My great-grandmother died in the mental hospital. Her sister was mentally ill. My brother has paranoid schizophrenia. He will be in prison for the rest of his life. And my stepfather was in the motorcycle gang, the Pagans, and she would wind up going to prison. And yeah, long story there. So I did become a Christian, and it was really life-changing for me. It was a very spiritual, transformative experience. But then I got saved from one hell, in a sense, into another in a very what they would call a legalistic church. Men couldn't have facial hair. Women couldn't even trim their hair, or it would be considered sin. And they would be actually scared of going to hell because of it. And so this kind of religious milieu created such a, you know, really bound me up in a very anxiety, a trauma-ridden way that I got to the point where if I drink soda, I thought I would defile the temple of the Holy Spirit and that I would go to hell. And I remember having an experience with, there was a visiting preacher where we went to this event, and I looked up to him like he was like God's prophet, you know. And I remember telling him that I drank wine at a wedding, just, you know, it was in passing, you know, talking about the wedding experience. And he looked at me and he said, "You are in danger of hellfire." I was like, "Why?" Because I drank wine. And within this religious tradition, it was called Apostolic Oneness Pentecostalism, even drinking wine was considered a sin. And that created such an indelible mark on my nervous system that I think that and many other experiences of really being scared of an omnipotent kind of God who can cause punishment, violent punishment, not only in this life, but in the life to come, really set my nervous system as a very sensitive soul to experience what we would call religious trauma at some point. So having my own experiences, then becoming a therapist, experiencing many other Christians and other traditions where religious trauma was a thing. And people don't realize this is actually a sort of a subculture. It's a subset of people. Because some people could be in a church like and come out of it like, "Yeah, I didn't experience any trauma. Yeah, I was taught about the rapture and hell and stuff, but I really didn't buy into it." But some people that I would work with would experience very debilitating symptoms due to religious trauma. And so then I really had a real passion for helping people recover. Not only, you know, can people be traumatized by authoritarian coercive leaders, so that's where spiritual abuse came from, and there's an evolution of consciousness around this stuff, but beliefs, religious beliefs, can also be traumatizing. Yeah. So this is something I've become very passionate about.
Yeah. Well, and thank you for sharing, first of all, about the losses you've experienced, your mom, and the things that have happened in your family, and all of the pain that you mentioned, even speaking so briefly about it.
Yeah.
And also for sharing about, you know, how this became what you focus in your work. And I guess it would make sense to me just to ask, like, obviously, I know about trauma, but how does religious trauma specifically show up for people? You know, you talked about being anxious and bound up in that, but there's like, as you were talking about, I was just thinking like,
sure.
Where there's the person who's in the experience, who's trying to kind of follow the rules, and it sounds traumatizing to have so much powerlessness and so much, you know, external control. And when you've already been raised in a traumatic home, that makes sense that would be both like keeping you in that environment and keeping you sort of frozen within that environment in a way.
Sure.
Potentially. Yeah. But what is it? How does it show up, the trauma itself, for people when they're dealing with religious trauma?
Sure. Well, maybe I'll start off by just talking about maybe an operational definition for me. And I'm very sensitive to defining trauma and religious trauma because I really want it to come from the heart and the mind and the body of people that I work with. But sort of in general, religious trauma describes the enduring harmful effects caused by repeated encounters with suffocating religious beliefs, oppressive and painful behaviors from religious people, such as, you know, rejection and demonizing and pathologizing. And we can talk more about that. But also constricting rules and confining religious structures. So religious trauma often has negative effects on one's nervous system, emotional landscape, view of self and others, and relationships. And so for me and others, the symptoms occurred gradually over time. I would say similar to drinking water contaminated with toxic metals, where an individual is unaware of the slow drip poison that slowly seeps into their body. And I've also experienced a couple of jarring religious traumatic events that was likened to an earthquake that can instantly shatter and shake an individual's foundation and leaves them struggling to regain footing in the world. So in a general sense that, you know, that's religious trauma. As Laura Anderson, she's coming out with a book, I think is phenomenal, When Religion Hurts. Trauma is trauma. Religious trauma is trauma. And so, you know, like I said, it could be due to beliefs, oppressive, painful behaviors, constricting rules and religious structures. But how it shows up can be different. But in the book, I talk about the debilitating anxiety that can come from this, of the trauma's effect on the body and the view of the body. Because remember, I'm also in Hell Indoctrination, I'm talking about original sin and the notion that we're no good. How often that I heard the lines of, your heart is deceitfully wicked above all things. There's nothing good dwells within you. Or repeating the scriptures in the New Testament where it said that our righteousness is as filthy menstrual rags, you know, or that there's nothing good within the body. It's fleshly. It's not spiritual. So hearing these messages over and over again, we're going to have a certain view of self that is very debilitating, very constricted, very shame-filling. And that's another piece of the toxic shame that can come from this. And then, of course, the bedfellow of shame of the self-criticism. I'm a sinner. I'm no good. I'm evil. Nothing good dwells within me. So, of course, you're going to walk around almost on eggshells in the earth and throw in some other doctrines of demons, right? Where there's like a demon behind every bush. That's the way it was for me in this Pentecostal tradition, where not only God can harm you for sinning, but God can send some demons to harm you, or it opens the doors to the devil. And so I remember being deathly afraid. Imagine the panic, the hypervigilance one would have. Like I literally would walk around like, who's a Christian, who's not? Who's like filled with demons and who's not? If I did this sin, be a little personal, I remember I masturbated. And that's a whole other topic of purity culture. You know, it's a big conversation now, not only for women, but men have been affected. But I literally thought that I would go to hell, that I would open the door to demon oppression in some way, because I engaged in a form of self-pleasure, where people in my tribe and religious tradition got kicked out of church for not being able to stop masturbating. So imagine the anxiety around that. And then I talk about betrayal trauma and, of course, rejection from the community. So there's a lot of consequences and how trauma can show up in religious context.
Yeah.
Sorry for throwing so much at you, but there's a lot, you know.
It's so complicated. And this is the same experience I had when I interviewed someone about purity culture. I was just like, the enormity just like is astounding because it's like if you're in, you don't feel safe because you know that you're inherently bad and you're going to screw up and you don't want to. And if anyone finds out, you will be out. But then if you're out, you know, you're also being, I don't know, abused, mistreated by, you know, being called all these horrible things and told all these things about yourself that are just as if like you don't deserve to exist. So it's kind of like a no-win situation.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many different, you know, consequences for this stuff. I mean, we all, you know, rejection hurts. Like that in itself, being rejected from our community. You know, we are neurobiologically wired to belong to a tribe and intimately connect with others. So when leaving our fold, a little sort of plug to Marlene Minnell's book, the sort of grandmother of religious trauma material. You know, it leaving our fold in our tribe, it could fill us with tremendous anguish and turmoil, right? Because we have a need to feel safe and to feel loved and belong. And so it really taps into that primitive aspect of our brain. And so these things, when we're kicked out and shoved out or judged for being out, our nervous system encodes these, you know, and loneliness and isolation and rejection as primal threats. And loneliness can cause anxiety and produce considerable amount of stress hormones, which ripple through our bodies and brains, with a lot of consequences to our immune system and well-being. And I think there is research where it shows that rejection has shown up in our brain. It's just the same area where physical pain is.
Yeah, right? I've seen
so
that.
So rejection is painful. It hurts. And it's just like physical pain, but people can't see it. You know, it's something that we hold within ourselves. And then again, throw in the isolation and the aloneness. So there's a lot of consequences to religious trauma.
Yeah. Wow. I know that so many people, first of all, so many people find comfort in religion and, you know, lean on it when they're in their darkest days. And then also so many people, I think, push those kinds of beliefs on other people, even in a desire to help them. Like, you know, I can remember with my children, you know, some family members who were very religious and we were not, who were very concerned about if we didn't have our children baptized, they would go to hell. And I was so offended by that. Like, my children are little balls of love. They're not going to hell. I don't believe in hell anyway. Yeah. But, you know, to that other person, to what I felt was they were being oppressive towards me, but in their mind, they felt that they were actually trying to help me and my children.
Yeah, it really does point to the complexity around religion. I always try to take a compassionate lens.
Yeah.
And, you know, these people, I was there myself, you know, I was telling people what I thought was the truth, you know, and part of healing from religious trauma is for some, there's so much guilt around, gosh, I told so many people that they were going to hell. And some people, you know, let's say LGBTQ plus, you know, where they remember, you know, shaming them and, you know, telling them that there was going to be this God who, you know, there's such cognitive dissonance. This God loves you, but if you don't do what this God says, he will send you to be punished for eternity. Like not just 10 years, 100, 1,000, 1,000,000, 1,000,000,000,000,000,000, zillion, like eternity to be punished because you did not do and believe in the right way. So that's one aspect of, you know, in some of my work, working with people is helping them heal from not only the trauma that was incurred to them, but sometimes a trauma that they incur upon others because of things that they were telling them. So there's a lot of nuance here. There's a lot of complexity too. And may I just say one more thing? You reminded me of the compassion. Religion and healthy religion can be healthy, you know? Like when I talk about this, I don't want to give the impression that I'm anti-religion, anti-spirituality. I mean, there's some beautiful aspects to healthy religion. And so I never want to knock that. It helps us to, you know, to make our way in the world when there's so much complexity and chaos. It can offer comfort and community and care. So I just want to put that piece in there. I'm not here to trash religion. I'm more here to talk about trashing toxic religions. And I'm not even talking about people. I'm talking about the beliefs, the system, the structure that's sort of involved in perpetuating these kinds of things.
Therapists, we've all had that moment. You wake up in the middle of the night. Oh my gosh, did I do my notes? Well, you don't have to worry about that anymore when you use Therapy Notes. Therapy Notes makes it easy to write your notes, get them done quickly, but thoroughly. My group practice has used Therapy Notes for 6 years, and everyone always finds it easy to use. But the best thing is, if you do need help, you can call their customer service number and a person answers the phone. And anytime I've ever had to use it, which is maybe 3 times in the past 6 years, my issue has been resolved easily with a cheerful demeanor in 15 minutes or less. So I highly recommend Therapy Notes. And don't forget, go to therapynotes.com and use promo code CHAT to get 2 free months. Yeah. Thank you for explaining that difference. And I know that it can be, things, again, can seem very black and white, and people can be very protective and when they feel that their belief system is being threatened. And I know so many people who have been raised, and this is another point I wanted to bring up, is you joined that that group when you were 21, but so many people never even have a choice. It's just literally the water they're swimming in when they're born. And I feel like there is, you know, developmentally and attachment wise, when we are in our first 3 and 4 years, the whole shame thing is a very important developmental stage that we can sort of get stuck with when things are overly focused on bad and good, you know?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. In my personal experience as a therapist, the most, the most severe religious trauma is found with people who grew up in religion. Yeah. Where, you know, the technical word for it would be more complex PTSD. And it's huge, and it's very intricate, the work, because they have to be able to tease out, which is very hard, the trauma that came from religion and the trauma that came from my relationship with my parents. And the entanglement within all that. And then there's also the, you know, gods in there too. So, and, you know, somehow in disentangling people's understanding of God, because some want to still hold to a relationship with God, but to tease that out that, oh, God is not the community. And it's possible that the community and my parents were not, you know, they had a version of Christianity. They had a version of God that they were in relationship with. That did not necessarily correspond with the God that I have come to understand as a God of love, right? So disentangling that. But there's also people who are like, well, screw religion, you know, F God. And I honor where people are at. And there's a lot of people who say, yeah, I've been there, done that, got the t-shirt. And I'm okay with either not knowing and being an agnostic, or for some, it's just a staunch sort of atheistic sort of approach.
Yeah, and I think that some people may be spiritual, but it's not a, quote, God that they're focusing on, but they feel like a connection with nature, or, you know, they're still having like a
higher power,
existential, spiritual experience that isn't necessarily like, I believe in God or I don't believe in God.
That's right, yeah. And there is a definition of religion. Or spirituality, that's a better word, that's being connected with something that feels more transcendent than who you are, connected to a larger framework, whether it's the universe, whether it's, you know, yeah, creation, or just other people in general, or some, you know, higher power that exists that we could never know, but I'm just aware that something may have created us. In the Big Bang.
Somehow, but, you know, something happened because we're here.
But that's okay. Yet. That's where people land on, and that's okay. For me, I don't need to get bogged down into the nuances or figuring out what religion is the right religion. Somehow we're all touching the elephant, and we're all thinking that the elephant is the real, or are part of the elephant, as opposed to maybe we're just making the best sense of the data that we have. And I'm just going to come to a place in being okay with not knowing.
Yeah. Well, I think that one thing that you said before, I wanted to name before we go into sort of like how people can deconstruct and how your book can help people learn about healing from those experiences. I just wanted to say that, well, one thing I was thinking of was that, yeah, that like, the idea that there has to be a right answer for spirituality, like what people believe. I feel like for me, I'm okay with maybe the rest of my life is trying to understand. Maybe, you know, maybe I'll get there before I die where I'll be like, oh, now I know what the answer is, or maybe I won't. But for me, that's okay. But I think what I was going to say was that when I can see how, because I'm also a trauma therapist and specialize in complex PTSD with, you know, abuse and chaos in the childhood and adverse experiences in childhood. So I feel like I can see how appealing it could be to have a framework where people who do wrong are punished. I mean, that feels really important to people who've experienced trauma and abuse and attachment wounds that no one was ever held accountable for or even acknowledged were real, that you not to say you, but one could be drawn to some kind of system that makes things just seem a little bit more clear. As long as you don't do these things, you'll be okay. And if you do do them, well, you're getting what you deserve because you did something wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Wow. You're really hitting on actually a bit of part two in my book. And that's looking at this from a sociological and psychological way of like, where do these beliefs come from? Mm-hmm. You know? And so in part two, I try to show that the eternal torture chamber known as hell is like an intimidating, ferocious looking dog with long, mangy fur, who after getting wet looks like a skinny, feeble, and downright laughable animal. And so my aim is to demonstrate that hell does not originate from a divine being, but rather a result of human ponderings about the afterlife, morphing into a narrative of violent projections that actually can bind communities together. And what you just alluded to is, as I was taking a sort of a macro view of, because this isn't just about Christianity, actually religion can be found all over the world. And many religions have a view of the afterlife where there's sort of this reward and punishment motif. And even with animism, which is the oldest view and understanding of religion, even that had a sense of, well, while it may have not been God who can be mad at you, the ancestors could be upset at you, right? And so I've come to realize that, and you said it perfectly, that part of the reason, another, the function of these afterlife narratives, such as hell, they have functions. And one is many passages of scripture and in other religion scriptures is to address oppressed and traumatized groups. And in a Christian sense, the Israelites, well, Jewish and Christian, the Israelites are Christians. So they were used, these narratives by biblical writers, to provide comfort and assurance to these groups, assuring them that the suffering at the hands of other tribes and unrighteous individuals would come to an end, that the perpetrators and evildoers would be punished while the oppressed would be rewarded with a form of eternal life with God. So there really is a function. And another function, just to mention one more briefly, was, and again, this is in various religions, it was historically utilized to enforce religious doctrines and practices. Why? To maintain social cohesion within the religious communities. Because the fear of eternal punishment or punishment by a divine figure served as powerful motivators, right, for individuals to adhere to religious teachings and norms while encouraging them to be loyal to their communities. So these religious narratives function, right, and those are true, at least in my understanding, from a sociological perspective, to encourage the oppressed and to maintain community cohesion. Makes sense. But, you know, as we have evolved, I think we can do something better than the stick. And I think the carrot and actually love and self-acceptance and other acceptance and, you know, decreasing tribalism, I think it's a good thing in our day and age.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I just want to add to that, like, quickly, that the whole idea of this eternal damnation, when, you know, someone's being told you're sinning and you're going to hell forever. And if it's something like identity, like who they are, being, let's say, gay, trans, you literally won't be able to escape from that for your life on earth, even if there's a possibility that this isn't true about the hell existing after your life, you're in that, a form of hell, you know, at the time.
Yes, yes.
Because you're just being told that who you are is just
intrinsically sinful, evil,
acceptable,
despicable, abominable.
Right.
And the reason why I'm so passionate about this is because what you just said, and here's the raw truth about this. Some people have killed themselves.
I know, yeah.
Because of these ideas, right? Because if you believe a God believes that about you, and God's community believes this about you, and then throw yourself in a family who believes what they all believe about you, people have killed themselves because of religious beliefs. So that's why this conversation matters. And that's why I care about this topic.
Yeah, because it's inescapable. even God, you know, sees all and knows all. Right. Like, what can you do? You can't change who you are, but who you are is unacceptable to God. I can see, you know, and I hope that, you know, maybe if anybody hears this who didn't know that there were other views, maybe that will help in some way.
Yeah, yeah. And speaking of other views, just really quickly, there are other views of the afterlife, even within the Christian tradition, because sometimes that's helpful for folks. Like, the fundamentalist, typical evangelical understanding of the afterlife is not the only version in town. And so there are other Christian understandings of what happens after we die. And it has nothing to do with a God who hates us because of our sin, and because we didn't accept Jesus will send us to be tormented and tortured for eternity. There are other versions, and we won't get into them now, but just throwing it out there. There are other more love-saturated and deeply relational versions of the afterlife within the Christian tradition, just throwing that out there.
Well, thank you. And I know that we don't have a lot more time, but I'd really love for you to, as you can, talk a little bit about, for people who are wanting to understand, like, how can your newest book help them where they are?
Yeah, this gets into part three of my book, where part two is more deconstructing from a sociological perspective. Part three is really getting into principles and practices that could really help on a nervous system level, which, if we're talking about trauma, this isn't something you can talk yourself out of. And so I spend over 120 pages in part three of the book that, yeah, very practical work that people can do. Because there are two aphorisms I mention frequently in my trauma work, is that facts will not heal the tracks, and information does not necessitate transformation. So remember, the trauma, any kind of trauma, but the trauma of hell indoctrination is lodged in the tracts of our subcortical nervous system. So since trauma's imprint is on the mind and body, knowledge alone is insufficient to heal. So it's impossible to talk or lecture a victim out of chronic shame, unrelenting inner criticism, unworthiness, helplessness, insomnia, rumination, flashback, nightmares, and disturbing feelings. So part three, I talk about all kinds of different ways, you know, so I talk about memory reconsolidation, imagery work that people can do. I talk about a little bit of sort of EMDR, you know, therapeutic work that people can do with bilateral stimulation and, again, compassion imagery. One of the most powerful work that I've experienced for myself and others is self-compassion work, and not just ideas, but this gets into Kristen Neff's work and others. Like, self-compassion almost becomes a subversive middle finger to toxic religion, where you were told that God thought you were despicable. You're told that the community thought you were despicable. But to be able to do work around fostering an environment within yourself where you can love yourself, you can love your body, you can relate to yourself as you would a dear friend who is suffering, as opposed to with judgment and ridicule and rejection. That's powerful for some, very hard, but that's part of the work, is helping folks be able to do that. And then working with the whole chapter on the inner critic and helping people work through self-criticism, and then parent wounds, a whole chapter on parent wounds, and then a whole chapter on values, right? What is it like to, it's almost like for those of us who are in religion, we have these tubes that were connected to the mothership, and we were told what to do and how to believe, and in our community, what to wear, what to listen to. And to disconnect from that is extremely disorienting to people, because it's now it's like, well, who am I? Who am I apart from what other people were telling me? And so helping people to figure out their own values and what they love and don't love and like and don't like, and what is the kind of life that they want to live. And even, you know, throw in a Bronnie Ware quote. I remember she wrote the top five regrets of the dying. And she said that something, one of those regrets I'll never forget because I take it to heart. She said that one of the top five regrets was, I regret living a life that others expected of me and not a life that was true to myself. It's like, wow, I don't want to go out like that. And so helping people figure out who they are, what they value, what that looks like practically, disentangling themselves from religion in that way and having a funeral for the gods in their life, the internalized other with big O, whether it's internalized parents or internalized divine figures who are harsh and punitive and telling them what to do or not to do, to have a funeral for them, to really to find a sense of liberation for who they are. It's so rewarding. So that's a little bit of what I get into in part three in the book.
Wow. Yeah, that's so powerful when you said having a funeral for the other. Mm. Like, just, I was struck by you saying how the, you know, I understand it's like a framework of how to live. The whole idea is it's teaching you what to do, what not to do, what's safe, what's not safe, but it's skewed in a certain direction. And if that's been your whole literally indoctrination of who you are and what it means to be alive, then you're almost like starting like a newborn baby if you're not, if you don't have that structure to work with.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a scene, I don't know if how many listeners or have watched the Matrix, but where Neo gets unplugged from the Matrix and just how disorienting it was for him. And to then have him find himself in a different kind of world, that what he knew was not real, and to now be a new human being in the world, the real world, their world, is quite powerful. Yeah.
Yeah. That movie, I still don't understand that. So that maybe that's part of my religious development. My spiritual development is to study that film a little bit more and really get what it's saying. Because I think part of, like, for myself, not having that background of, you know, religion, literally, my husband can watch that and he's like, oh, this represents, da-da-da-da. And I'm like, oh, okay. I didn't know that, because that's not my like paradigm. Yeah. But well, we have time for one last little point, I just like to say that one of the things that I can imagine would be really hard about that deconstruction that you were just describing is that if you were raised in an environment where you weren't supposed to ask questions and you really weren't supposed to think for yourself.
Yes.
It's like, how to even do that? And I've seen that with people who it's like, wait, I don't know what I believe. I mean, am I allowed to think for myself? Like, what would that be like?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, we didn't talk about this one piece. But one of the other consequences is, you know, many of us in these traditions were taught that our bodies and emotions are inferior, untruthful, unspiritual, and fleshly. And so biblical propositions and reasoning were emphasized as the primary vehicles to truth and living the supposed Christian life. All that to say is we had to split off then. I was in my tribe, emotions were considered demons. I know it's so weird, but they would literally, I bind you spirit of sadness, or I bind you spirit of anger or spirit of lust, and try, you know, we'd be prayed for with the understanding that if someone was depressed, that was because of a demon. So they would try to cast that emotional experiences out. So, but there's a problem with splitting our emotions in that way and consider them inferior. And without that, we know that emotions have valuable information. You know, we cannot fully understand and process our experiences, and it would lead to a disconnection from our core selves.
Yeah.
And so not being in touch with our feelings or our authentic self has a lot of ramifications. And that's part of the journey is like, no, your body is good. Your feelings are actually trying to tell you something. Let's listen to them. Let's honor them. Let's see what they have to say. But that can be so difficult, right? I don't know. This sort of the disgust that people can have, my sexuality and pleasure. It's just so sad, all of these different layers of religious trauma. Because the more we talk about it, the more layers that are unfolded here.
Yeah.
And it's just, it makes me really sad that religion at its best is supposed to bring forth the most powerful and embodied and loving human beings, but paradoxically can create so much pain and trauma and hurt and disconnection from our core selves. It's really sad.
Yeah, it really is. It really is. Thank you for your vulnerability and for what you're doing to change this for others. It's really impactful and hopeful too, because from what I hear you say, it sounds like in your book, people can really begin doing this work through the practices that you have there and not just having to, teach about it and then let me go find out where that is, but actually being able to experience it a little bit just through trying some of the prompts in the book. So that's really valuable.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
Accessible.
And then there's like 10 or 15, there's a link in the book to 10 to 15 meditative audio, meditations that people can help bring. Like, I'm all about that's healing. Wonderful. I don't want to just deconstruct, but I want to help heal, you know? Don't want to be an angst-filled person who's just talking ill. Now, I think it's a phase. I think it's an appropriate one, anger and rage and then hurt. But I'm a little past that, wanting to be on the other side and bring some hope and healing.
Well, I'm really grateful that you've shared your time so generously today and that you're doing what you're doing. So just let us know quickly, where can people find all your stuff?
Sure. Well, any book is going to be found on any place you can find books. Got my website, markgregorycaris.com. I'm a little bit of a dinosaur when it comes to social media. Probably the introvert in me is like, too much of a beast. But Facebook, just started. I know I'm really late to the game here. Instagram. So yeah, that's it. That's about it.
Hey, it's okay. There's no timeline.
I know.
But you said it's markgregorycaris.com?
That's correct.
Okay. I'll be sure that we put that in the show notes so people can go directly to your website right from this interview. And Mark, thank you again for sharing your wisdom today and for everything you're doing.
Thank you so much, Laura, for being here.
Try Therapy Notes, the number one rated electronic health record system, available today. With live telephone support 7 days a week, it's clear why Therapy Notes is rated 4.9 out of 5 stars on Trustpilot and has a 5-star rating on Google. Therapy Notes makes billing, scheduling, note-taking, and telehealth incredibly easy. And now, for all you prescribers out there, Therapy Notes is proudly introducing ePrescribe. Try it today with no strings attached and see why everyone is switching to Therapy Notes, now featuring ePrescribe. You can get 2 months free by using promo code CHAT at therapynotes.com. Trauma Therapist Network is a website to learn about trauma and how it shows up in our lives and to find a trauma therapist. Go to traumatherapistnetwork.com to find a trauma therapist near you today.
Thank you for listening to Therapy Chat with your host, Laura Regan, LCSWC. For more information, please visit therapychatpodcast.com.